Welcome to SelfDiscoveryWisdom.com, formerly known as Self Discovery Media. On these podcasts, you're going to hear people who speak from the heart. They've taken the journey in life. Many things have happened to them, but they've changed it to happening for them. And in their strength, their courage, they've discovered their abilities and their wisdom, and they are now sharing it here with you. Do enjoy each show. We bring it to you with love and knowing that it's going to help you on your journey of life. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Choose Positive Living right here on selfdiscoverywisdom.com. I'm your host, Sarah Troy, and my wonderful guest today is Renzo del Castillo. We're going to be talking about building the gaps between people, building connections and empathy through creation, art, integrity, and love. And also talking about his book, Still. We've got a lot to talk about here today, so I really want to get to it. But first, I'll tell you a little bit about it. We're going to be focused on bridging the gaps between people and building those connections and empathy through creation. But we also need to really look at what life is all about when we have those wonderful transitions. Like, he is an immigrant. He is from a country that did not speak English. And there's an awful lot that he had to navigate along the way. But how did he navigate? Well, he said originally he had an abstract goal to publish a book before he turned 40. However, in the last 7 years, he lost a significant member of loved ones, his dad, his grandmother, his best friend's mom, his cousins, even his dog. The relationship he thought that he was going to evolve into a marriage broke down during this time, and he felt life had stopped giving him things that had started to take them away, which makes absolutely no logical sense. But this is where he was emotionally. Writing the poems that make up this book allowed him to process everything he was feeling during this time. This is why this book is called Still. He learned to be patient and present with the moment and allow himself to feel the process of what he needed to feel. Also, in Spanish, Still means to deva. I have to
Todavía.
Ask. We'll have to ask about that. And no matter what he is here to do, and those who have moved on with him in his are in his memories and what they have taught him. And we're here now in this story, and it means the world to him that to anyone who reads this book and know how love it really is the propeller forward. And yes, he was born in Peru. Educated at the University of Florida in BA in English and Victorian Literature. Oh, that's fascinating. He is an absolute fan of James Bond. I'm with him on that. We've got lots of James Bond bubbles there behind him, which is wonderful. And it's allowing life to happen to us, and it does happen to us, and it does happen for us, but it doesn't always happen in a way that we like. And I imagine even leaving Peru, because it was under duress, you had to leave, that even leaving a home that you knew and then coming to a new country, all of those upsets can either make you or break you. They can either open up a world to you of exploration, or they could cripple you. And it really comes down to that choice, doesn't it? Welcome to the show, Han.
It's an absolute delight to be here with you, Sarah. Thank you for that wonderful, lovely introduction.
The journey, I mean, it's actually kind of funny, but the universe gives me people, and I don't coordinate this. It just is the way it happens. But the shows that I've done in the last couple of weeks are on a lot of grief and transition and allowing ourselves to grieve the loss, to make a discovery of how to move forward without people and how to keep them in our heart, but at the same time, step up and live and move forward. So you have so much loss happening at a short period of time. And I love the title of the book, just Still, being still enough to acknowledge, still enough to feel, still enough to see what it means to you now. Was that hard for you to be still? Did you go through a little roller coaster first?
I am not good at being in the present moment, which is why I put so much practice into it. Even doing something like yoga, where you have to be uncomfortable in a pose for an extended period of time, you can't think about the future because you'll fall, right? You'll fall on your face. It was very difficult for me. I mean, my mind tends to be on the future. In my professional life, I'm an executive in healthcare, and I came up as a project manager, risk mitigator, right? So I'm always thinking about what can go wrong.
Yes.
Which means my head is in the future. And I think that comes from always moving. Even leaving Peru, we migrated. We had a situation there and we left, right? We moved forward. We didn't, and I'm not saying we should have, I'll explain a little bit more about that, but just, I had a lot of difficulty just being present. And when you talked about all that loss, it was very difficult for me to just take a moment and process it. I was taking care of my mom, taking care of my sister, even when my dad passed away from pancreatic cancer. So they gave him 3 months to live. It was stage 4, but he lived for 3 years. And 2.5 years without morphine, we were very lucky. The last couple of months weren't that great. But I had to, nobody else could. So I had to help him plan his funeral. Like he wanted to leave that all addressed, the burial plot, all of those things, which I don't enjoy, but I can do. But I think I was able to do it now in retrospect because I didn't stop to think about it.
Yeah.
And when you don't do that, it builds up. It goes somewhere. It has to go somewhere.
Yes.
So it builds up and eventually you'll wake up one day and you will just feel overwhelmed by grief. It might present itself in shortness of breath. It might present itself in being short with your loved ones. It might present itself in breakouts. You don't know how it's going to present itself, but it's going to catch up to you. And one of the reasons, as you mentioned, this book is called Still, is that I had to learn to stop, process it, deal with it, accept it, and then move forward knowing that it's a part of me.
Yes.
Grief will always be a part of me. And
it
I went through
have
that
to
process
be painful,
with everyone.
Though, right? That's the thing. Yeah. You miss the people and you know that they're still within you and you miss the fact that they're not physically there anymore to have a conversation with. But you can think about them still in I miss you, but not it's so painful to think about you.
Yeah, of course. You get to that point, though. I think at the beginning, pain is part of the process.
Yes.
And I also believe that we are in danger of toxic positivity when we say, hey, let's get away from anger. Let's get away from fear. I think all of these feelings, they're neither good nor bad. They just are.
They're and a reflection of the moment.
Right. So
how you're feeling.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've placed this value on them. And it's like, I can't be angry. Or I can't feel guilty. But so many good things come from guilt. Atonement as an example, right? Anger, release comes from anger, right? So there's these, all of these things that occur. So I think grief, while painful, and it is, you've lost a piece of you, right?
Yes.
Or you think you've lost a piece of you. But the other reason this book is called Still in Spanish, Todavía, is that they're still here with me.
Yes.
I realized that we are made up of all the little pieces of everybody we've ever loved. They're part of our personality. They're part of the things that James Bond, you mentioned it, right? I used to watch that with my dad when I was a kid. Maybe not appropriate. I hope my mom's not listening, but I used to watch it with my dad when I was a kid. And my dad was a pilot in the army. So that was the thing, like that meant to me that I was going to spend time with my father. And then I eventually really got to enjoy it. If I'm out and about, I'm typically in bespoke suits. I enjoy them because my grandfather always dressed in a three-piece. He was, when my dad wasn't around, my grandfather raised me. The first time you tried sushi is an example. Did you do it because you're like, this looks good, or somebody you cared about said, hey, this is really great, right?
Exactly, exactly.
So all of these things, the way that I comb my hair, the way that I tie a tie, the way that I smirk, half smile, right? That comes from my mother, my father, my grandparents, all these people that have touched me. And if that's true, then they're here with me. They're still here.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
100%. We are particles made up of, you know, the universe. We're made up of past memories. We're made up of experiences. We're made up of the DNA of our ancestors. It's all a little hodgepodge going on inside of us. The same goes through that if your family members have gone through trauma and not dealt with it, we could be born with that trauma inside of us and not even know what it is. And just know that, you know, we're anxious or we're always mad or we're fearful. And it's like, it doesn't even really belong to us. And this is why I always see each generation, you owe it to the next life that you will be to make sure that you, you know, address all those things in this lifetime.
Yeah. And I think that that's why community is so important to me. And I think in general, right? Like we are, it's like the universe and the atom. The atom is a mini model of the universe. If you believe that, then the universe is just a greater representation of that. I think that as we are, everybody that's ever loved us, mm-hmm. I think that's why it's so important to build community, to build family. Yes. I think while some people do prefer to be isolated, I honestly think it's a fallacy in the sense of how we grow up. I don't think anybody ever does it on their own. Somebody helped you once. Somebody did. Somehow, yes. Even
well,
if it's just to
do
open
it
a door.
Very well on your own, right? Yeah. But they become the teachers. You know, so many people that I interview didn't have the help accessible for them at the time that they were going through one form or other of transition, and so they discovered things for themselves, which they have now made their platform to help other people through it because of that experience. They became the teacher because of their experience, because they knew what was lacking, what they didn't have. So there is that advantage of it, which now they can be there in empathy and understanding for people with the skills and the tools that they need to apply. But I totally agree with you. We need to be a village. That village is as strong as everybody's participation. When somebody's Agreed. Down, we pick them up. When somebody's celebrating, we celebrate alongside of them. But our community is as strong as our participation in that community with each other.
Right. And not being, we were just, you know, discussing that pre-podcast. We can't be passive, right? No. Like we can't be passive in this. And even when we're alone, just as an example, like the other, a month or so ago, I was offered a position that I ended up taking. And I thought to myself, I wish I could talk to my dad about this. And then I'm like, I actually know exactly what he'd say.
Yes, exactly.
So even if they're not here with you, you can go back into your memories and be like, okay, he's going to say this and this and this and this. I have the advice. I can
the other thing
forward.
Is you can talk to them, mm-hmm. right? And they will speak back to you in signs. It's not like they're going to come back to you and necessarily speak in your ear, but something will present itself, which is, okay, all right, I got the message, right? And that means be aware. If you're going to ask these loved ones the questions, the guidance, then be aware in the way it turns up.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Because it never comes, it's black and white. But yes, the memories are all inside of us, but they're also still here guiding us. They're all around us still. And it's that essence of who they are, that energy of who they are is what we can tap into. And I think it's very important. My dad died when I was 11, and I was just beginning to have a relationship with him. And it was something that, he wasn't looking at me as the little girl anymore, that we were all sent to boarding school early in life. So he actually came out one day just to take me out for the afternoon, just him, which he never did. And he died shortly after that. So maybe there was something he knew. But it was beginning to have those conversations because I was at that age where he could. And unfortunately, it got cut short. But that doesn't mean I still can't have those conversations. I don't have such a huge memory bank, right? But as I've grown older and learned more about me, I've learned more about what he was struggling with or more about him and his life. And I think it's as we learn more about ourselves, we realize how much we're made up of everything and everybody around us.
That's fascinating. I'll be honest with you. My dad was super Catholic. So I tend to hope that if he's passed on, he's not here, that he's transcended to be with his God. My sister, however, my sister has three kids, I have three nephews, and we were going somewhere as a family and we came back and the lights were on and she swore she left them off. She's like, oh, that's dad. And I'm like, if that was dad, he'd turn them off and say, save on electricity, you know? but I would lie to you if I told you that I didn't feel his presence in more than just my memories.
Mm.
So I think there's something to that.
Yes, most certainly. And it's all about connection. Connection when we're alive is connection when they're gone. It's the connection to self. And I think, so many people are seeking connection on the outside without first connecting with themselves on the inside and, being still enough to to be present and allow things to be revealed to you, because so many people are chasing the outside for their solutions where they lie on the inside. And, outside skills and tools may be presented to you to help you on your journey, but it's the inside wisdom. of understanding what it is that you need to recognize those skills and tools on the outside.
I definitely agree with that. There is so much. I just mentioned an atom is the model for universe. There's a universe inside us, right? There's so much we don't understand about how we work, how we process, what we do. And I went to school for aerospace engineering before I graduated from Victorian Lit. I switched like 6 credits short of graduating, which my immigrant parents loved. That was a great Thanksgiving.
Why?
And Christmas. Yeah. Well, it comes from a place of they were afraid for my safety, right? Like, how are you going to make money was the question. Yes. What are you going to do?
It's always the big question, the number one question, not about how you're going to be happy. It's always about the money.
Right. I mean, I'm guilty of that, though. Like, I, as a kid, if you asked me what I wanted to be, well, let me go back. So we came to the United States from Lima, Peru. We came because our lives were threatened by a terrorist group called Shining Path. My mom had, she was the secretary to the Minister of Health. And there was a union negotiation where people came in armed. And because she was a woman, she's like, I'm going to go get coffee. And they're like, okay. And she went and got the police. And then they marked her. Yeah. Okay. Right.
Yes.
Then they marked
her
for death.
Retaliation. Yes.
Yeah. And one of our nannies was a terrorist. They found her before she did something. One of the nurses, when my mom gave birth to my sister, was a terrorist. And there was another incident.
So warning signs were there and they paid attention to them. Yes.
Yeah. So, and it was crazy because when my dad passed, I cleared out his office. Again, one of the things that I could do that my family couldn't. Mm-hmm. And I found like the paperwork from the trial. I'm like, this is insane. Like, this is doesn't even feel like it happened to us because it happened so long. We were so young, but it definitely felt like it happened to my parents, right? That's part of them, mm-hmm. that situation. So when we came, we started with nothing. We were very lucky that my mom's big brother, my godfather, sponsored me for a student visa. I didn't have some of the issues some of my, you know, fellow immigrants have in terms of legal status, but we started with nothing. So we went from being like upper middle class, lower upper class, to just having nothing. So there were nights when my parents would say, hey, go ahead, have dinner. We ate already.
Yeah.
When it wasn't true.
Yeah.
And I was young enough. I was old enough to know they weren't telling the truth, but I wasn't old enough to understand. I didn't have the life experience to understand why yet, right? But it marked me. It marked me. Like, I always love to say this, like, it made me very Scarlett O'Hara, you know? As God is my witness, I will never go hungry again. My family won't go hungry again. So
I'm sorry, I'm just envisioning you in the curtain there.
Right? Exactly. So when I grew up, I'm like, what do you want to be? I want to have money, because to me, money was safety. Money was nobody turning off our lights. Money was everybody well fed. Money wasn't scrambling for rent. And this is no criticism of my parents. They tried, right? They tried really hard and we're here because of them. But I think that their reaction to that was fear-based. But it was fear born on love, right? Like, there's this complex, it's not just like fear is bad, love is good, right? Yeah. Love can have all of these deferring things tied to it. And I think fear is important because I think absence of fear is stupidity, right? Like, you just don't know. Like, oh, let me just jump off this. I'm not afraid. No, fear is facing your fears, right? So it's good to know these things. And I just wanted to have money, and it made me very unhappy for a long time. So when I switched from aerospace engineering to poetry, because I stopped being obsessed with how things worked and started appreciating that they worked at all.
Exactly.
It was a very difficult time for my parents. I was gifted. I had, you know, scholarships. I had the high IQ, which obviously has deteriorated by now because that's a quotient. it was definitely life-changing. And going into that is when I started, I mean, I always knew Neruda and I always knew Bukowski and Szymborska, but I just started diving into E. Cummings and diving into Seamus Heaney and Oscar Wilde and, you know, like all of these different poets from different areas. And it was, as I mentioned, we didn't have much money. So What my parents gave me was a thirst for knowledge. I learned how to read pretty early on, around the time I was 2.5 to 3. So by age 7, I was reading The Count of Monte Cristo. So I was
Yeah.
observing and inputting
You
all
were
this travel, like,
absorbing. You were
yeah,
absorbing. Yeah.
all this travel I couldn't do, right? But something in me, and this is where I go much more to the intuition than the logical, which is my safe space is to go logical, right? I have a difficult time being still and being in my intuition. I always knew I wanted to travel. I didn't know why. I knew that traveling was something that was necessary for me. It was oxygen. Now I know that it breeds connection, right? It allows you to see different things, do different things, understand different things, meet different people. I honestly think that if God exists, he, she, it exists right now between us connecting, having this
Yes.
conversation in the
Yes.
space between, right?
Yes. The
So
good vibrations.
good vibrations. Go Beach Boys. So the so I think I lost the question, but no, it from going to that, switching over to poetry was a very big change because of how we came up. And it's interesting how it was based on love and fear, you know?
Well, I mean, I've got a different approach to fear because, I've probably been fearful all my life because of the limitations placed upon me. But I look at fear now as this the common sense fear. The common sense fear keeps you safe. It stops you doing stupid things and, makes sure you don't put the hand in the fryer. It's common sense fear. Now, when you put common sense fear with instead of fear of the unknown, but wonderment of the unknown, then that fear is going to protect you while you're on the adventure of inquisitiveness, of growth, of wonderment, of what is. And everything I've done, I have absolutely no idea if I could do or not. I had no idea where it would take me or anything. Everything I've said yes to has always had a fear base to it. Can I? Can I? Can I? And the only way I can find out if I can or not is if I do, if I try. And so I, it became more wonderment, even if it was fearful in doing it. It was like, if I don't try, I'm not going to know.
Not going to live.
Not going to live. Exactly. Fear is a crippler. And this is why we see so much sensationalism in our media, because you keep people in fear, you cripple them in their thinking, and therefore they don't think for themselves, that you make puppets out of them. And that is a fear that I feel that is something that holds us back as a society, stops us communicating, stops us asking questions, stops us willing to want to know, and just cripples us completely into paralyzation of fear and paranoia in many ways. And I think that inquisitiveness is something, and that wanting to connect, wanting to know. I did a lot of traveling, BC before children, and I got to meet all sorts of people. I absolutely loved meeting people from different walks of life, sitting at their table, eating their food, just the different cultures, but what was the commonality, right? It was a zest for life, a love for each other, kindness and generosity. And when you looked at it, that was the foundation of everybody's plate at the table. It's just everybody served a different style of dish. And I think if we could look for the commonality between us, what are we all fundamentally looking for? And that is to love, to be in a loving space, to count, to feel we're contributing. If we could all acknowledge each other in that way instead of the divide or the fear base, I think we would grow as a human race quite considerably.
I love what you said, that you felt this while sharing a meal, which to
Yes.
me is one of the most intimate things you could do as a family. It's a first, like when you go out on a date, when
Yes.
you share, like the it's such a like this is me
Yeah.
creating, and I consider food art, right? Like creating
Yes.
this work of art and sharing, I'm making this and I share it with you. This thing that breeds life, I share it with you. What a way to share culture. What a way to
Yes.
share intimacy. What a way to share of yourself. You actually put yourself in the meal and give it to others to nourish them. Beautiful metaphor.
My son's love language is food. He owns a restaurant. And
Okay.
when he actually does cook for you, everything is love-based. The presentation of it. Do you like it? And it's I'm giving you my love. Are you receiving it? You know, and that is for him. Like when people leave his restaurant with a smile on the face and a smile in the tummy, you know, he's happy, right? He's shared his love. And I think we've all got a love language. Yours through poetry, through art, mine through interviewing. We've all got something. It's that discovery of what is our love language? Why do we love it so much? And why sharing it is so important? And I think if we could adventure ourselves into that discovery and ride those beautiful waves, we would be so much more authentic in who we are and why we are and what we're here to do. You know, yes, you could have been a very good aerodynamics, et cetera, and you could have made a lot of money. Do you know how many people I've interviewed in their 40s and 50s and said, I had this six-figure career and I walked away from it because I was as miserable as hell? And now I'm doing this, you know, ice cream truck. I'm the happiest person in the world, right? Because happiness, heart, soul, spirit, mind, body, happiness is the currency. That's where the wealth and the enrichment truly is.
Then how am I going to keep all those beautiful James Bond toys behind me? No, I'm just kidding.
No. What we have to do is find something we love to do that actually pays us.
Well, you know what? What you're saying resonates with me. I have a really good friend. His name is Curtis Franklin. He went to grad school with me. And he's in his early 60s now. He's a bit older than I am. And I was, as I told you, I was just not happy. It was like, what happened? Well, I'll go back again. And now I know where I'm ending. So I went to school for poetry. I got into Cambridge in a program. I had all these dreams about being a long-haired hippie poet walking around Cambridge and doing all that stuff. And because of the immigration situation in the country at the time, I'm 40 years old. So when I was graduating, it was right after September 11th when I entered college, and that was 2001. And back then, it was up to the discretion of the immigration official at the gate at the time.
Yes.
Whether they let you back in or not. And I had two friends who studied abroad, and they were deported. They weren't terrorists. So they're fine now.
That was the hysteria, right? Hysteria.
It's fear-based, right? And it's also, but to be fair, like an event happened, right? There's reasons for all this stuff. And I came in with a student visa, and the people who blew up the towers came in with student visas.
Exactly. Everybody's marked.
So my parents sat me down and said, hey, how about you finish here? And I didn't fight them, right? Like I was fine with it because I knew what they sacrificed, right? And it was logical, but I was heartbroken. I stopped writing. I stopped doing poetry, and I went full corporate, right? Full. So I was, the career that I have now is a result of all the seeds that I planted during that time. I might've not done the planting in the best state of mind, but I don't regret it. There was a time after I became financially successful. I had no debt. I knew my family was going to be okay. I had achieved a certain status, but I wasn't happy, to your point. And I talked to Kurt, and I'll never forget this. And this is how he talks. So he's like, what are you passionate about? And I couldn't tell him because everything that I did was in relation to someone else. Right. There's reasons for that. But I didn't know. And I got a little frustrated. Thank goodness he's my friend and put up with me. But I'm like, what does that matter? It's like, what? He's like, because your passions will lead you to your purpose. And a life of purpose is one of joy. Again, that's how he talks.
Absolutely.
I love that man. Love that man. So I took some time to figure out what I was passionate about. And I love brain teasers, puzzles, like mental exercises, things like that. And I also, whether it's narcissistic or not, I like helping people. I hope that after this conversation, you're better off because we met.
Exactly.
I would love that.
That's the reason why I do this. It's fed me so well over the years, not financially, but, you know, spiritually and emotionally.
Exactly. Yeah. And that eventually, and I worked in healthcare, which I considered a failed system. So it was making me very unhappy.
Yeah.
But now I realized I could solve complex issues every day. And now I realized that I could help grow my team, the people that report to me, because the truth of the matter is I'm an executive, right? They work for me. No, I work for them. I no longer do. by being a people leader, I enable others to do. And it's a completely different skill set.
Yes.
It's like a different mindset. You have to put ego aside because you're no longer doing, right?
You're creating leaders.
I had a number of project managers working for me. You think that I didn't struggle with, like, I could have done that better? I was the best. I was the best at this. I was a consultant. I was a gunslinger. I came into town, grabbed my money and left. I became a sheriff. I had to make sure the town was cleaned up. I had to make sure it's a completely different thing. But it's a thing that has fulfilled me much more than any individual accomplishment I have ever made whenever one of my people is recognized.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm proud. I guess pride is not the right. I'm just happy for them. Because
pride is okay. People give pride a bad rap, but I
think
you can stand tall and proud
of
achievement.
I'm proud of them.
Exactly.
I'm proud of them. Yeah, I'm proud of them. I'm proud of them. No, but it's not the feeling that I have. It's more like, God, they've seen their potential.
Yes.
They're starting to see it. They're like, they were hazy based on all the clouds that they had internally, right? But now they're starting to see it.
They've stepped into themselves. Yeah.
And the most rewarding thing is not when they see it, is when they start to believe it.
Yes.
So I'm very happy at work now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I'm very happy at work. It's still the same industry. It's still the same type of job. It's still corporate America that has its issues. But I've managed to find
substance.
A modicum of peace,
yes,
a modicum of fulfillment in it.
We want to know that whatever we're doing is providing a service or providing something that's going to help other people in life. What you're providing for them is the strength and the courage and the abilities to see their own potential in their own service of how they can serve other people confidently, coming from a place of their own truth, their own passion. And to ignite that into other people is beautiful, because when you ignite that in other people, you've given them their wings. You revealed their wings. And now they can really take flight and do what they've come here to do. And inspiration begets invitation. And when they're inspired, right, other people are invited by that inspiration to look at their own wings.
Mm. And it's important to create, I think the most important part of that is to create an environment
mm-hmm.
where they feel safe making mistakes.
Yes, right? That's how we learn.
Because I've learned much more from failure or from not succeeding than I have from succeeding.
Yeah.
Right? I've learned much more, and I want them to know it's okay. The only thing that's not okay if they keep making the same mistake. I hold them accountable to learn from it.
Yes.
But it's been very fulfilling.
You know, and failure is, again, another one of those words that, for me, failure is when you've given up and you've given in and you don't even try anymore. You know, I think all those mistakes, they make us flawsome. They reveal flaws that we are challenged with, like a broken bowl. But when we put ourselves back together with love, we put that bowl back together with love, it can be abundant in what it can hold.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn from all those reveals of our flaws, of our characteristics, of our mistakes. And it becomes something that kind of deepens us and rounds us out more. I would rather have somebody who has had experience than somebody who's just got a degree.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because I think that, again, corporate America, I remember graduating, and I graduated 2009, so I didn't do anything I went to school for. It was during the housing bubble.
Right.
So times were tough, and I had the degree, but they wanted the experience. And then I've seen others who had the experience, but they wanted the degree. And when you had somebody who had both, they wanted 3 Olympic gold medals to pay you market value. You know, it's just, you have to know what it is you want to do and then go for it. You know,
right.
You have to,
and,
you have
and
to
be willing to go in at different avenues. You're like, you know, my son, before he opened a restaurant, are you an 84 or an 85, baby? Or an 83. My son's 84. So, you know, for him, he went on a different path altogether, but food was always his passion. He took over cooking in his teens, which I was quite happy to do, sick to death of cooking 3 meals a day. Mind you, the kitchen and the pots and pans were to the ceiling, but the food was great. And he discovered that passion for food. He discovered it was his love language, and eventually it brought him into going into the restaurant business. He's just been away on a pre-wedding honeymoon, because they're getting married in August, they can't really take time off then. So pre-wedding honeymoon, and left his staff knowing that everybody would be okay because everybody feels a part of the restaurant. And for a whole week, which he does every single year, all of the profits made in that week go to the staff.
Beautiful.
So it is supporting the staff, it's giving them a voice, it's giving them a place, saying, "This isn't my place, this is our place."
Give them skin in the game. Make them
Yeah.
feel they belong. Make them feel
Yes.
they're it's theirs too.
Yes.
It's a lesson I learned too and at work. And I also feel that, with the book, when I had the book release party in Miami at there's a one the biggest local bookstore here, which I adore, is Books and Books. And what we did was, I do a lot of stand up open mics and all that stuff. And there's a Miami poetry community. I invited 12 poets to come read from the book, because it for me, as I don't know if I've mentioned this, but it's about building community. Building community is
Yes.
so important to me.
Yes.
It was also a little bit of a treat for me to see their interpretations of my work, because I
Yes.
believe when you create art, it's
Yes.
yours. But when you
Yes.
put it out there, it's no longer yours.
No. Same with
You
these
can't control.
podcasts. No,
Yeah.
exactly. A book or anything, right? You
Well,
can't.
1,000%.
Yes.
1,000%, because it's every, like I mentioned, we're made up of all these little pieces of people that loved us. We're also made up of all these experiences that make
Yes.
us uniquely. Nobody can make a podcast like you, because you're you, right? It's not ego. It's just you've lived a life that has led you to here.
Yeah. This
Nobody
is
will write
this
this.
is my frequency, and somebody else has their own frequency, right?
Exactly.
And you're going to get drawn to whichever frequency is speaking to you at the time.
Exactly. And then nobody can write this book the way that I
Right.
did. However,
Exactly.
once I put it out there and I performed it, but to see 12 different poets
Yeah.
that I care about and respect, and all of them made it, which in Miami is fantastic. It's not something that normally happens. To see them perform it. It was just, I was blown away. It was such a beautiful thing to be a part of and behold. And
It
but
came
what
to
it does,
life, right? It came to life.
yeah.
Yes.
And
It's
they
not
did it
just
in
your life
ways.
anymore. Except that was that connection and that community by other people participating and revealing what they felt about it. So that brought it to life and expanded it out.
Yeah, I didn't know that certain pieces had the emotion that they brought out in it. And I didn't see it because I have my
Yes.
experience blinders on.
Yes.
But just to see how universal creation can be,
Yeah.
right? And then they take this, it's like plastic, right? They take this piece and then they perform it and they turn it into their own. It's like when somebody does a cover of a song,
Yes,
right?
yes.
Like that. It was just fantastic. So I'm to your son and the way he runs his business. Cheers to him.
Yeah, and to you too. I recently had a similar experience in a different way. I've been putting this book together. Yes, I'm being shameless. I've forgotten children, people. And it was.
And where is it available?
Yeah,
Where
is
can we
that
get a
available
copy?
on Amazon? International bestseller. Yes. And it was, I gathered 14 other people for 15 of us in this book. And I didn't know what I was taking on. I had done this before on a smaller scale, but not on this big scale. And I'll be honest, like trying to get authors to do everything that you need them to do at certain times is like trying to herd cats at times. But I did a summit where they all came, and over that summit, each one of them had 5 minutes to talk about why they said yes to the book and what their chapter was about, what their platform was about. And at the end of that summit, everybody was so impressed with each other. They suddenly took the book seriously. They suddenly realized what we had there, why the book was so important to get out. And that for me was that final kind of, yes, I've got it right. And that's that feeling that, because you're always in doubt when you're doing something. Should it, which shall I change it? Da, 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 da. I wrote my own book. I stopped editing it because otherwise I'm just going to second guess all the time instead of it being the organic of what came out. And having all of them be behind it because they saw then beyond their own chapter, beyond their own story, of how it was an accumulative story. It's the same with your poetry. Each poem represents some aspect of your life, but having 12 different people read those poems, it becomes a reflection of their life, a connection with what they've been through, and it changes that story and expands it out and just deepens it even more.
And it's so representative of the fact that we are part of something greater. And it feels better when you recognize it, right? Like just
Yes.
to feel connected.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, you certainly can.
What is, I don't want to say biggest, but what is the lesson that you took away from that experience of going into that summit and just seeing, having your expectations be flipped, but in such a positive way? And such a, it seems again, I keep using fulfilling, but just the fulfilling way that, I mean, you lit up when you talked about it. If anybody's watching this video, you're going to see what I'm talking about. You so lit up that I'm just curious about what was it that went through your head? What is that lesson? What is that memory that you got from it?
I am not a structured person. I am completely and utterly in divine soul to heart to spirit to clarity. I allow things to come through me. And everybody that came to me for this book was, for me, divinely given, because I wanted to do this book 5 years ago. And then last year was, I'm doing it this year. The time was right. But the people that I went up, because it all came from podcasting. It all came from the podcasts I've done with people where I'm thinking, this needs to be a bigger story. This needs to expand out. But only two of the people that I approached were still kind of in business that could do the book. And so it was like, I'm now ready to do the book, but where are the people? And then people came to me to do a podcast on whatever they do. And then in the discovery of what they do, I'm like, you've got to be in the book. And so I got, you know, 12 other people in this book. And you get to that human second guessing. I've tried to be as diverse as possible and not repeat any particular topics, and are they the right people? You go into that human aspect of it, right? And then at the end of the summit, when everybody had spoken and everybody then really saw who everyone was, their passion, their conviction, their dedication, their advocacy for children and family, their desire to see change. And when that came across from that summit, which is out there on the orchardofwisdom.org, folks, under our Forgotten Children book, you can see it there. It then became that validation that, you know, I listened, I paid attention, I followed my gut, my instincts, my truth, and it came to be. And that's, you know, that is, it's that yes, it's that yes, right? And then when the book came out and people have been doing their chapter shows with me, and it came out. We made that international bestseller. It's just, it's a fundraising book as well. So all the money raised gets divvied up amongst all the authors, organizations that support family and children. So it's an awareness and fundraiser. But when you've had a vision, now you had a vision of poetry, how many years before? This was being a vision for 5 years. And then it suddenly comes to fruition where you feel, I can touch it. It's tangible. It's real. I haven't got the books yet. They're coming this weekend. But, you know, then it is like the dream was real. It's validated that you were meant to go down that path, you know, and I trusted my gut. I trusted my instincts, and it did not let me down, as it never does when I trust it. It's only when I go into my head that I go wrong.
That's funny. It's funny because my experience was whenever I'm a very emotional person. But I can be very, like I said, my safe space is intellectualizing things because I have those aspects of my personality, right? And I'm working through, I believe that you are correct, right? I believe that that's where I strive to be. But I know that in my experience, my journey was whenever I trusted my intuition, that's when I got hurt. Doesn't mean I was wrong, but that's when it hurt. And the safe space was to analyze it, put it away, compartmentalize it, try to make sense of things that sometimes make no sense.
But what about your poetry? Did you allow it to come out of you, or did you dictate?
It's interesting because, as I mentioned, we didn't have much money. So my parents, my grandmother was like a college professor, opera singer, like this Renaissance woman who was amazing. She played dodgeball with us and did all that stuff too, right? So she was great. She was total package, my dad's mom. And her and my grandfather on my mom's side, they always, because I read pretty early on, they were always giving me these books, my parents too, right? So my grandmother was the one who introduced me to poetry. So poetry's always been a part of my life. The other day I found a letter she wrote me when I was 5, which was an acrostic, just this long poem of my name that she wrote in very florid colonial Spanish language, right? That you give to a 5-year-old, but the 5-year-old could read it, you know? So it was this interesting thing. And then as I grew older, I had a my cousin who passed away. He was run over by an SUV about 5 years ago.
Oh, no.
He was my age. He was born a week after me. We were in the same
Hmm.
crib. We went to the same schools. We were both in the gifted program together. We
You're
both
like
did advanced
brothers.
classes together. We were always together. We always thought we were going to be old men on porches together. He in high school was part of a rap group. And he's like, you know, you should do poetry. He didn't ask me to rap for everybody's benefit. But he said, you should do poetry. And I'm like, nah, man, I don't think I can. He's like, dude, you should do it. Like, what's holding you back? You know all this stuff. You're really good at writing. Like, just you're great at expressing yourself through words. Just do it. I'm like, okay. So I did it, and that's where it started. After that heartbreak, it was like a breakup. Just the idea you have for your life,
Yes.
right? It's in something that you've invested yourself in. I mean, I don't mean to downplay like a divorce, but it kind of felt like that from what I saw
Oh
my
no.
parents go through, you know?
You know, we talk
Because
about loss. Loss comes in many different ways, right? And to lose a passion and a dream is just as impactful.
yeah, so I went, like I said, fully corporate and I became very successful. I was unhappy, then I was happy, but I wasn't writing. When my father passed, I went to this, now she's a really good friend of mine. There's this Russian Miami-based photographer called Anastasia Samoilova, and she's exhibiting like in the Paris Fair. Like I think she has a new one opening in Malaga. She's exhibited in Berlin, Madrid, etc. There's this work she has called Flood Zone, which is about living in climate change and threshold spaces in climate change. But she's very not overt, right? She's Russian, so you can tell she's gonna love that. And I met her the first time I met her at her exhibition, and we hit it off. We started talking, and the topic of me having been a writer came up, and she said, "Oh, well, do you have something?" And I'm like, "No, I haven't. I'm not a poet anymore. I haven't written in a long time." She's like, "Well, write. Just write." I'm like, "About what?" She's like, "You like my pictures?" I'm like, "Yeah, write about that." So I did, and then I also had a really good friend from middle school, Mike, who is a character. But he works in the arts and fundraising and all that stuff. When he's not in the army. He's been waiting, apparently. He told me, "Oh, you're writing again? Good. I've had this strategy on submissions for you since middle school." And these are the journals that you have to submit. Here are the lower tier journals, the mid tier journals, the high end journals. If you get 3 published here, we can get a book deal. If you get 6 published here, we can. So I had all of these, and there were others. So I had all of these beautiful people in my life that have, I wouldn't say push, but yeah, maybe they did. Maybe they pushed me to get out of my own way and just start.
Yes, they believed in you before you did.
Well, allow myself. I think I blocked it because I'd hurt. I
Yes.
like that. That hurt a lot to be able to not be able to live the life you think you want, and reconciling the fact that I can be an executive, and I can be a poet. I don't have to do either.
Right.
I remember I had a conversation with a good friend, Maureen, saying, "Did I sell out?" And she's like, "Renzo, collect the paycheck and write after work. Like, just you're good." And I'm like,
Not
"I
everybody
guess I
has to
can."
be the poor poet, right?
Exactly, right? So I did that, and I've had a lot of teachers along the way. These people that I've mentioned, they've all been teachers. And when it comes to putting that into the poetry, I had some are from the portfolio that went to and got approved for that program. Some, because I took, you know, poetry classes in college and all that. I studied with William Logan, who's a fantastic American poet and critic that's, I believe, had like tenure at UF. I have to look him up. I wonder what he's up to. So I've been classically trained. So I have these tools, and I guess in a way, I've always been writing. I just never put it down on paper because the second I did, the book is, I don't know, like 160 pages long. All of that came together in months. It was just, I was incredibly prolific in a short amount of time.
Because it was waiting to get out.
Yeah.
It needed to get out, right? And that's when I wrote my book, it was fine. I'm giving you 3 weeks. I was going to audio it and then transcribe it because I'm better at talking. And then I just started putting my fingers on the keyboard and off it went, right? Because it needed to get out. And that's the thing, is that's where we need to allow and we need to surrender, because this is, you know, what we were designed for. This is what we're meant to do in this now. And we get in the way, we make excuses, we put obstacles in our way. But when we surrender and say, I am, I will, then it just flows out of us of what is meant to be, all that has been stored up. But this time your poetry will also be mixed with life experience. And so it'll probably be even fuller than it would have been back in the day.
Yeah, and surrender is something that I'm coming to terms with now. I'm much better at it now, but it was something that I would not do. I would not bend the knee. I would not surrender to the moment. I would not do any of this. And I think it came from that whole safety thing, because I needed to be in control. And then you realize you're a kite floating in a hurricane, right? So
yes,
and that's from a James Bond movie. Don't give me too much credit. But we are, right? we are kites and hurricanes. To think that we can control the weather is fallacy, but we can control how we adapt. We can choose how we adapt.
And that's the point.
Being the person that you hope to be allows you to navigate these situations with some grace, you know?
Well, you know, the allowing, it was at 57, I was given the opportunity to be on somebody's podcast network. And I said, what's a podcast? I had no idea. This is back in 2012. I was on her podcast network for 13 months and it was live. Ooh, good training ground. Things dropping, things not working, people not turning up, you name it. Great training ground, but I got the bug. I mean, all these wonderful stories. It was all these fabulous people. I need to have a place to platform them. So I started my own network. Still didn't know what I was doing. And it was all a navigation as I went. Okay, I need to add this. Now I need to change that. Now I need to do that. And this evolved into books and evolved into, you know, membership directories. And it's just like, okay, now time to expand or to redirect. But the core has been built. Over 12 years, that core has been built. And who I am now is so different from the girl that started nearly 12 years ago. I'm 69 now, so I'm not 57 anymore. But it's what I've learned about myself through sharing other people's stories, from meeting other people in their journey, that self-discovery of who I am because of it. And I think this is when we're willing to share ourselves and willing to share the challenges and the obstacles and the triumphs and the pain and the joy, we are being relatable to people who are also on that journey. And it inspires them the day they don't feel alone. B, there is a, you know, a rainbow at the end of the tunnel. And here are the tools and the skills or the attitude I need to take in order on my own journey. So I think that inspiration begets that invitation. So even your story today, your own struggle of surrendering, of pivoting to another direction, even though it broke your heart because your heart wanted to go another way, but rediscovering your heart later and taking your expertise and that structure and that ability you have and bringing it now into your poetry has just probably made your poetry a lot more rounder and a lot more deeper and a lot more meaningful because of the life experience along the way.
I would hope so. Do you think that we definitely grow and we expand and we evolve.
We hope to grow, yes.
Do you think your core though, at your core, that you're still that person, you're still pretty similar to who you were? It's just somebody that now sees the possibilities of what could have been because they've been.
I look back to me as a child who was a spiritual being, dimensional traveler, being able to see beyond the veil all my life. And then I stepped into adulthood and responsibility and expectation and parenthood. And I kind of lost myself along the way. I have come back to the core being of who I am and what I'm here. I'm here to ignite heart and souls. And I'm back into the core being of who I am meant to be. I'm back to my truth, but I'm back with more in my kit.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
More arrows in your quiver.
Yeah.
But you're still the same archer.
I am. I just, you know, probably with a keener eye and a more attentive ear. So, you know, the beauty of age is that You don't just rely on the knowledge anymore. You trust the wisdom to reveal what knowledge you need when you need it.
That is an encouraging thought.
I'm a big one about surrender and allow because, as the human condition is always to dictate how things should be. But when you surrender and allow and trust the divine, God, universe, spirit, source, energy, whatever you want to call it, when you trust that and it becomes your compass and it resonates with your heart and truth and your heart gets excited about it and it gives it to your spirit of action and it goes to your mind to extract what you need in your mind to give you the clarity of that action when you need it, then you know that that is the perfect marriage between experience and knowledge and wisdom and how to use it. And I can only do it from that way because the other way failed me. And this way always leads me down the right path. If I go into the other way, I go into the knowledge and the doubt and the inadequacy and it doesn't make sense and things are in my way. But when I go from this angle, I'm in truth. And the knowledge is more prevalent and more important to that moment.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense of peace in a way, even if you're in the middle of action, when you know you're being authentic to what you believe in yourself.
Yes.
It doesn't mean there's no adversity. It doesn't mean that you don't have challenges, but
there is
a self-assuredness and a confidence that goes along with it, right? So I definitely, so for example, when I published this book originally, it was a tax break for me. Like I wanted to publish a book.
The rational mind.
And I wanted to have a tax break. And then I went to see a film called Past Lives. I think it's up for the Oscar this year with a fellow author who did from the publishing house here in Miami, who did, her name is Annie Vasquez. And she wrote an advanced praise for the book, right? They collect different people to write it. And she asked me like, oh, what are you going to do with the book? And I said, blah, blah, blah. It's a tax break. She looked at me like I kicked her puppy.
Exactly.
And she stared at me. She said, your book, I've read your book. It's more than a tax break. And just, that was the first moment. And I'll always be grateful to her for that because that was the first moment when I stopped talking about it in that sense.
Yes.
Talking down. I mean, it has value. Yes, it's valuable, but I was minimizing.
Yeah.
It's what I used to do with compliments, right? Like,
yes.
Oh, you look very nice today. Oh, well, you know, blah, blah. Like just minimizing the, and just instead of just accepting
yes.
the gifts that people give you, whether with words or accepting love, right?
Accepting.
You want to give love, but you have trouble taking in love.
Yeah.
Like those are things that we have to work on. But when she said that, and then when I started doing more open mics and having people come up to me with tears in their eyes saying like that unlocked something for them, or the best compliment that I've received a number of times now, actually, which gives, it's my life's blood now. It's when somebody comes up to me and says, I read your book. I want to write something now. I want to do something now. Because it's
that inspiration begets invitation.
That engendering of creation. And that's what we were talking about. I think that's been the theme of this conversation. Like, I think I mentioned to you earlier, it's so easy to tear things down, literary criticism, like this movie sucked, this director is garbage. Yeah. But instead of, maybe you don't like it, but you can admire the technical mastery that came to it because somebody put their life's blood into it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And appreciate, maybe it's not your flavor, but you can appreciate it for what it is. Right. So now I think it's so much easier, I said, to tear things down than create. And I think creation has helped me be in the now, get away from languishing, be an active participant and a value add to others, which is what I wanted to be. And I'm generally much happier.
Yes.
You know?
You found your happiness. And that happiness is in service of others. It is truly when you know that you're sharing what ignites you, that love that comes from you, you let your cup run off over and you are of service to others. It is such nectar back to you because we really want to be of service to each other. We really want to know we count. We're here to contribute. This is the connection in the world. We do not stand alone. We need to be a community. We are a community, whether we like it or not. And we need to connect and understand that that serving of each other is what makes the village strong. And that village is only going to be strong as we get out of our own way and stand tall in who you are and what your contribution is. But understand the importance of that contribution to that village is just as important as somebody else's contribution. I call the analogy with the orchestra. We're here to discover what our instrument is. We can learn how to play it, and we can be a brilliant soloist. However, when we come to an orchestra, we want that orchestra to have all of those individual beautiful musicians come together in their strength, but harmoniously play together to transcend their music into a beautiful symphony. Together, they are beyond. Singularly, it is just one instrument, right? You reading or writing your poetry is coming from your one instrument. Other people reading it is the orchestra contributing.
I really like that. Matching frequencies, as you would say, in this short time that I've known you.
Yes. Yes, I'm all about those good vibrations. I love it when people make that discovery and you're never too late. And you're still young. I mean, I've got a child older than you as well. It's never too late. I've met people in their 70s and their 80s. The oldest person I've interviewed was 92 with her own TV station, took her lover at 90. She's 94 now. She's still going, right? And it's never too late to make that discovery of self, of who you really are from the inside out, from the core out, and what your contribution is. And, you know, we have in our youth passion, but when we find a life experience, passion becomes deeper. It comes from that core base of commitment and of life's blood, right? It is you. And it's a different form of passion where it really then reveals a deeper depth of life experience along with your instrument and your passion.
Yeah, I'm not really contributing much right now because I'm taking all of this in. It's a compliment. Take that as a compliment, because for me, music is a necessity, right?
Oh,
I must have music. I must have song. Others don't feel the same way. I know a lot of others that do. And to think about it in those terms, because there are people that say, oh, I'm not creative. I do math. Abstract mathematics is one of the most creative things I've seen.
Yes.
Somebody who understands math can understand how to play music, can understand meter and rhyme and structure, right?
Code and everything else, right?
And I think that comes from, you know, labels. I mean, when we were first having a discussion, I'm like, am I poetry? Am I lifestyle? Am I this? Yeah. At the end of the day, it's just us.
Yes.
Right? And we're having
You're
this conversation.
You. Just I am, right?
Just I am, but yes. Right now it's us together,
yes.
Right? A little like maybe it's a duet. Maybe it's not
yes.
a symphony, but it's a duet, right? And what's coming out of this could only happen by us exchanging ideas, right? Which is why I think it's so important that if anybody wants to paint that painting, write that book, start that podcast, but they're like, oh, I don't know. What are people going to think? To hell with what people are going
to
think.
Who cares? What do you think? Why
exactly.
Is everybody else's thought more important than what your thought is?
And I think that comes from what you mentioned before. You were, and I was, my inner child, and then responsibilities,
yes,
and assumptions, and expectations.
Compliance.
Expectations and compliance too happened.
Yes.
And we, for a while, I think we, out of best intentions, tried to live the life we thought we needed to live in order to be good partners, good children, good parents, good, this thing about being good, when
and being
we
different
weren't.
Was bad.
Yeah, and we weren't
no.
good because
no.
it wasn't authentic, right?
No.
So finding out that, you know, one of the, I think the fact that I'm doing poetry now, that I have a career, as my mom's like rewrote the script a little bit. She's like, I always supported you. I've always wanted you to do this. And I'm like, there was that summer that you didn't. But but it's also not true. She's always supported me. She's always, if I wouldn't be doing this, if it wasn't for the book she's given me, for the times I doubted myself, that she came in and said, like, no, you are this. You are worth it. You are beloved, right? And the moments when I forgot, right? Because of expectations, because
yes.
of life. And to come back and not having to have that voice in my ear because it's part of me now.
Yeah.
Right. It's here.
It's an extension of you coming from your very core.
Yeah.
But then you have the peace of mind on the other side of it. You know, you have that intellectualism of your work, peace of mind of the salary, knowing you're having an impact with other people at work, but then your expression of self and heart and soul is here on the other side with your poetry.
Yeah, and I definitely have ego. I studied this. I know that I know how to do a villanelle. I know how to do a pantoum. I know I know meter. I know guzzles. I know all this, and I think I'm good at it.
Right.
But that doesn't mean anything compared to somebody coming up and saying, "This helped me."
Yes.
This is beautiful. This helped me. It's interesting because at this point in my life, thank you for saying I'm young, but at this point in my life, I've lived about half of it, give or take, and there's another half that's expecting me. And if you think about it, life seems eternal when you're a kid, because when you're 10 years old, 1 year is a tenth of your life.
Yes.
At 40, 1 year is a 40th of my life. Everything is going to go faster, right?
Yes,
just by relativity. It's so important to me. The greatest currency I have right now is time, right? To be able to use this time and not, I don't have any regrets, really. I think regrets are a waste of time. I think if I go back in time, I'm always going to make the same choice I made in that moment, knowing what I did at that point.
Yes.
I don't think that gives you carte blanche to be a jerk to people, but it's just, I don't think it's worth spending time in regret. But now, learning lessons from my father, from all those people you named, that my dog, my Pearl, you know, like that. That's
mine's on the window and picture behind me, yeah. My baby. Yeah, she's still just with me 7 years later.
having all that just reminds me to just appreciate the moments. Like I'm treasuring this conversation because this is our time together.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to speak to you after this. I really enjoyed your conversation. If I don't, then I will always treasure this in some way. You get what I'm saying? Because this is our time.
Yes.
And it's finite. And I think I'm very Blakean in that sense, right? Like a rose is beautiful because it is finite. So time is beautiful because it is finite. What
it's being are you the gift going of to... the present is in the now.
Exactly. Because when you live in fear, you're living in the past. You're like, this happened to me. And I did that for a long time. I lived in the past and I lived in the present. I don't want to do this again. I'm sorry. Live in the past and live in the future. I don't want to do this again. How do I prevent it from happening again? And then I completely forgot about all the wonderful things that were happening.
Right now.
Right? But now I realize that the present moment is a direct result of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And the future is a direct result of the present. So really, why don't I just put my mindfulness in the now? And
see
in doing
today
so,
what you want to grow tomorrow.
Right. And in doing so, I stopped being a perfectionist and wrote the book, like got it done, got it out, instead of going like, does this punctuation need to be here? No, it'll change the meaning. The critics will hate it if I, you know, like, like it doesn't.
The human chatter, the brain chatter, not the heart chatter.
Yeah. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good enough. And
what's perfect anyway? It's all open to interpretation.
Exactly. I'd rather have high standards and try to achieve them. Then freeze when things are not going the right way.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that's that's something I think that I've never been a person to reach perfection, and because for me it's always been an illusion. The expectation of me growing up was zero. Let's hope she makes a good marriage, and that was it. So for a while it was like nobody ever thinks I can do anything, and then hindsight showed me, well, you know, I could do that. It's just because I gave it a try. And that discovery of what I could do and who I really was and where I really fit in. And it has been a lifelong journey. And I realized that all of the things that I've done, in a lot of ways, has been disruption. You know, the jobs I was in, I have had three bosses that have been fired and I've been offered their job. Never wanted their job. I just wanted them to do their job properly. And I never stayed with the companies when that happened, but because I was really there to shake things up and show them what they weren't paying attention to. And kind of when you hindsight, you look at it, I'm kind of that disruptor of shaking things up for people can see what really is happening, what the real truth is, and what we can do about it. Because if we're in ignorance or in denial, or refusing to pay attention to the now, which is screaming at us, we're going to make wrong decisions for tomorrow.
Yeah. It's funny because you call yourself a disruptor. I've realized that I've always been a safe space, but for similar purposes, so that people can make realizations, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's interesting how we're coming to the same point.
And it's all the kind of the same frequency, just done in different ways, you know?
Yeah.
And
Our own instruments.
Yeah, it basically, again, people living in the fear or living in the future, but not living in the present. And for me, it was to show them their present. I mean, will you please stop planting weeds and expecting corn to grow, you know? And I was that shake it up. The universe 6 years ago gave me a saying, the universe is going to shake us up to wake us up, for us to step up and change it up and grow up. Grow up vibrationally and grow up as a human race. My job is kind of shake it up a bit, right? Shake it up to wake people up so they can see what needs to be changed up, and to grow up vibrationally as a human race to a higher consciousness. So I'm still doing what I've always done, but I was unaware that I was doing.
I can see that. I can see that.
We all have so much potential, but because of what I call the human condition of societal dictation, we're all chasing an illusional carrot of what we should be and what will make us happy. And when we realize that carrot isn't even real, and I'm not happy, you know, you can get the nudge, nudge, wink, wink, or the cosmic 2x4. But when we do wake up, this is not my truth. This is not my story. And you're still enough, long enough to pay attention to what's not working for you and start going from the inside out and looking at what's your core, what's your passion, what's your conviction, what makes you get up every day with a smile on your face, and then apply it. Then you can move forward in your own authentic truth and happiness will be.
It's transformational to realize that the world that you believed in and lived in for so long doesn't exist. I'll tell you a very brief story. I think we might be running out of time, but I'll tell you a brief story.
We're fine.
When I grew up, as I mentioned, I learned to read pretty early on. The way that I learned to read apparently is my parents read to me, right? It wasn't on my own. But my godfather had sent me blocks, letter blocks, and my parents took me out for a drive. And I was like, stop, go.
Yes.
Yield, right? And they're like, oh, how cute, he memorized the sign. And I'm like, supermarket this. They're like, wait, what? So they ended up taking me to a psychologist for a test, because right around that time, my dad took me to see my grandfather's grave, his dad. And he explained that his dad was in the grave, and he was waiting for the dead to be, you know, raised again. And apparently I woke up 3 nights later screaming, I don't want to spend eternity in the box. I don't want to spend forever in a box. I don't want my dad to be in a box just crying. Right. So they took me over there. And that's where they found out that I had a very high IQ for that age. So my parents, both very intelligent people, I was higher than them. And my dad was somebody who valued knowledge above everything, right? He grew up in a house. His dad was a surgeon. His mom, as I mentioned, was an opera singer. She started a nonprofit for single mothers. She was an activist. She was a university professor. So when I grew up, I would come home and my dad would be waiting for me at his desk, you know, and I would come home with a test. I was like 9 years old. And I would hand them the test. It was a 95, right? And he looked at it, and I'll translate. Were you sick? No. Were you emotionally distressed? No. What could you have done differently to get the 5 points you needed to get 100? Okay. I come home the next time with 100. Didn't mind that I set the curve for the class or whatever. I come home with 100, and he's like, were you sick? Were you emotionally distressed? I see here, son, that you chose not to answer the 2 extra credit questions. I'm like, yeah, I didn't need to. I had 100. And he said, son, God punishes pride. If you want 100, you have to study for 200. So I grew up thinking that I was never good enough, right?
It didn't matter
how high it was, didn't matter all that stuff. And then as I grew up, I would bring this up to my dad and he'd like, yeah, look how good you turned out, slap me twice on the cheek and laughed and went away, which would infuriate me. So 3 weeks before he passed, I was outside doing yoga. And he was, you know, he came out and sat down to take some air in the backyard. And because my dad was sick around COVID too. Mm. So we were all like, I wasn't going to the gym. I was like at home and working from home and all that stuff. And he's like, son, I'm worried about your immortal soul. Okay. He's like, you're doing this thing that's not Catholic and all that. And for some reason, normally that would trigger me, but that day I had patience. So we sat down and we talked. And I'm like, no, I had a bad car accident. If you remember, yoga really helped me out. Also, what I told you, it helps me be in the moment, in this discomfort. And I need that. You know me, Dad. I need that. Then the conversation led, and I don't know if you ever heard something you needed to hear, but you didn't know you needed to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad told me, I know I made you feel like you weren't good enough growing up. And I'm sorry. First time he's ever said, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you were smart, and I was proud, and I didn't know how to deal with it. But you're my son, and I love you, and I know you, and you're never happy if you've half-assed anything.
Yes.
I still need the therapy. I still have issues. I still dealing with all that stuff. But the gift was, when I go by my father's grave now, we had a good relationship. My dad, like, I don't want to paint, it's a complex picture. He had that, but he was also like Ted Lasso, like goofy and loving. And he was an army major, so he was very strict. He had all these sides to him. Definitely had an awesome mustache growing up. Like, he had the Tom Selleck mustache, which was amazing, which I can't grow. I didn't get that. I didn't inherit that. So, but when I think of my dad, there's a resentment that's not there that probably would have been there if he hadn't said that.
Exactly. That was his parting gift.
Yeah. And to me, I believed, I don't know, like, I know my dad loved me, but I felt like I was always striving to be good enough for his love in a way. Right. The same way, like, I felt this similar about my mom. I know she loved, my mom is very loving. I know she loved me, but I felt like I had to emotionally, like, what I had to do for my dad intellectually, I had to do for my mom emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always people pleasing, which is, it's in my nature to be very nurturing, but it wasn't good when it was transactional.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But now I kind of veered away from it and I'm like, no, I am nurturing, but I'm going to do it because I want to, not because I expect anything in return. And that helps you. But anyway, when I had that experience with my father, my world is different than it was. And it's a world that allowed me to produce, you know, the book, right?
Yeah.
It's a world where I feel loved, where I allow myself to feel loved, where I can take a compliment without, you know, feeling like I didn't earn it. I have to earn it, you know? And what does earning it mean?
Exactly. And denying the compliment is an insult to the person giving it.
Yeah.
This is a lesson I had to learn in order, because I was such a people pleaser, and turning into a pretzel, bending my back backwards, please everybody at my own expense, that when anybody did give me a compliment of any kind, I didn't believe them because I didn't believe I was worthy, always self-critical, and didn't realize that I was insulting the person who is giving a compliment or trying to help me. And it's been a big lesson of allowing people to help me. All right. Still a struggle sometimes, but
yes, accepting help is difficult. But I also learned, like, even in romantic relationships, right, with my girlfriends, you know, if they were into me, on some level, I didn't believe it. So I was disregarding. Mm. I was disregarding their agency, their intent, and downplaying it.
Yeah. You know?
Which doesn't make you a good partner.
Nope.
So it's,
did a show this morning on relationships.
There's waves to this, right? To your point, water or frequency, whatever you want to call it, like, there's layers that you have to unearn. But actually, that's the fun part too.
I think just don't beat yourself up. There is no such thing as perfection. I love the word flawsome. We've all got flaws.
I like that.
And the thing about flawsomeness is this, you know, look at a bowl that's been broken into pieces and you're putting it back together with self-love. And not only is it stronger than it ever was, but it can take an abundant amount of love and let that love run over. And if we can embrace those flaws, those quirks, those idiosyncrasies of ourselves and understand it's what makes us who we are, right? Forgive ourselves of our faux pas, of our mistakes. And, you know, I think self-forgiveness is one of the hardest things to do and one of the most necessary things to do. And stop beating ourselves up, because that is an outside thing of not living up to somebody else's expectation, right? You reacted or you did what you did at that moment based on what you knew. Forgive yourself. You know better. You won't do it again.
What's that Japanese art of mending broken pottery with gold?
Yes.
I'm blanking on the name, but I think
with
it's
gold.
A very
yes, I don't know the name. Yes, they do it with gold. I decided self-love is much stronger.
No, of course, but it like that viewpoint of this thing that broke, it has more value now.
Yes, just right? Like it's a flawed diamond has more value.
Very powerful.
Right? Yes, and there's this: what is perfect? You have perfect moments in your life. You have a perfect situation. It is a moment in time that is perfect. It is not meant to live up to the standard of perfection all the time. Otherwise, we'll become complacent and we will not strive. We strive for those perfect moments. But understanding that imperfection is just as beautiful. Right?
Agreed, doctor. Agreed.
Okay, my love. How do people get hold of the book? How do they get hold of you? Where can they see you reading your poetry?
So I live in Miami, Florida, in the United States. I do open mics almost every week. There's an open mic every third Monday of the week in Books and Books in Coral Gables. Ink and Flow Poets does it every once in a while. And whenever I'm invited, I do that. The book is available on Amazon. I was just sharing with you. Very happy to say that it's an Amazon bestseller.
Yay!
In multiple categories. So that was a cool thing to wake up to earlier this week. It's available on Amazon. The book is called Still. My name is Renzo del Castillo. I'm sure we can put it on the show notes or something to that effect.
It will all be here, but this is also for the people on the audio.
Okay, so STILL is the book, and my name is RENZO space DEL space CASTILLO. You can also find me on Instagram at LRENZ, at ELRENZ. I post a lot of content about that, and I have RenzoDelCastillo.com, same spelling with a .com at the end. And that's a website that's in progress. And who knows what we'll do tomorrow. But you can find it on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, BooksandBooks.com, and different local bookstores here in Miami. Thank you.
We learn so much from other people's stories. We learn so much about ourselves. But I think the biggest thing is there is hope. There is relatability. But I think the biggest thing we learn is compassion. Compassion for other people, compassion for ourselves and our own journey. And when we can step into compassion, kindness, caring, and love, we realize that that frequency, that vibration, is the healer of all. It is the generator of all. We can never give enough love. We can never receive enough love, because our love is, once the more you love, the more your heart generator fulfills. And when you love what you're doing and love whom you're serving, love what you're about, then that love is something that just transcends and finds its way through every crack and starts healing. So don't be afraid to step into love, and don't be afraid to step into your calling, your passion. Don't deny yourself. Don't deny us, right? Because you are denying everyone else that love of what you're doing. Step into what you love doing. And that frequency goes out there into the ether and it lifts everybody up and this planet and everything. And Lord knows we need it, folks. We need it.
And I just, not to interrupt you, but I just do want to take the moment to thank you. Thank you for creating this space. Thank you for giving me a platform, for sharing your platform with me. I've really enjoyed what I've heard of your podcast before coming on. I really connect with your mission, and I just wish you the best of luck. And I hope that we stay in touch.
We will stay in touch, most certainly. And thank you very much for coming and being open and honest about your journey and where you're at now. And I think also the biggest compliment to yourself is the fact that you did allow 12 other people to read your poetry. You weren't territorial or guarded over it. You allowed and surrendered to other people's interpretation of it. And instead of going, well, I didn't write it like that, but, oh, that's fascinating that they see it that way, right? So that is a big compliment to you for doing that.
Can we get a sound clip of you saying I can surrender and share it with my therapist? Because that'll be great. That'll
just
be fantastic.
Give her this video. She'll learn a lot about you.
No, that's very kind. Thank you for that.
Sometimes we surrender and don't realize it. You know, this is the big thing I'm going to leave everybody with, which anybody who's watched my shows knows that I say this all the time. Do not think your thoughts, feel them. When you feel them, it comes from wisdom. It resonates with the heart truth, spirit action, and you know what you need to know when you need to know it. When you think thoughts, you'll always find a way to get out of it, or obstacles, or something else, down the rabbit hole. When you feel it and that knowledge comes to you because you're feeling it, it's clear, it's concise, it is. So please feel. Thank you so much for being here today. I really, really enjoyed it. Folks, go and get the book, Still. Read it yourself. And it'd be a different interpretation to maybe to the way he's written it, but what does it mean to you? That's what poetry, that's what song, that what dance, that's what art is all about. What does it mean to you? What reflection on your life is it having at this moment? Read it, feel it, absorb it, and allow it to be. So until next time, folks, bye for now.